Now, over the last few decades, the cost of college has skyrocketed. More students than ever before are taking out both federal and private loans to pay for their schooling, or they're looking for grants and scholarships to help defray the costs.
New legislation being proposed in the nation's capital aims to bolster the federal Pell Grant program, which an estimated 9 million students nationwide rely on to pay for a portion of their higher education.
Representative Ron Kine joins us now. He represents Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He's proposing the Pell Grant Funding Act. Representative Kind, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Tell us about this legislation you're sponsoring on the Pell Grant.
You know, I've introduced a Higher Education Action Plan. We have a higher education bill that's coming up for reauthorization. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to look into higher education policy. How do we make it easier for high school students to start developing career paths, whether it's through internships, apprenticeships? How do we make it easy for them to transition to higher education programs for them? And part of that is making sure it's affordable. And that's where the Pell Grant comes in. Pell Grant is something that's given to the students to help them pay for their educational expenses. I was a direct recipient of Pell Grant when I went to school. I was first generation in my family to go on to college. I also did work study on campus, cleaning bathrooms for 4 years. I also had to take out student loans to help pay for it. We just need to figure out ways of making it easier and more affordable for students to continue to do that so we're not pulling the ladder up from behind us.
So what would change in the way Pell Grants currently work to make those things easier?
One is make it year-round because you have some non-traditional students who want to jump in, they want to jump out, whether it's the local community college or technical school. And if you make it year-round, you start shaping these programs around the needs of the worker or the student themselves, rather than asking them to fit into a certain block. So that seems like a common sense proposal that we should have done a while ago. I also like to see us expand the eligibility of Pell Grants and the amount of the Pell Grant award, because there's been so much emphasis in recent years to put students in greater debt with more loans. And that just puts them in a huge financial hole, just as they're starting out their lives or their career or a family. And it makes it hard for them, quite frankly, to be good consumers then, to buy a car, to buy a home, or to support the local businesses. This is a big challenge that we face with $1.3 trillion worth of student debt out there today. I don't want that to be the next economic bubble that bursts and takes our economy down.
As I understand it, especially after some changes in 2011, currently Pell Grants, they're really targeted toward what we think of as the traditional undergrad, the person just out of high school, and they're going to college for 2 semesters out of the year, taking the summers off. Do I have right. that right? That's what we're looking at right now?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it's currently structured in that. And yet I've heard from a lot of the technical schools, 4 of whom are in my congressional district, that the program could be made more flexible and easier for students who want to come in during a certain finite period of time for a certain job program or education program, and then get back out again so that they're not incurring more debt in the process. So more flexibility, listening to the needs of the students and our educators, finding out what's working and what isn't. That's the type of approach that I'm taking.
And you're also hoping to provide flexibility if that student, maybe that more traditional student, wants to not stop at 2 semesters. They want to cram in those summer classes, too, and maybe get done faster.
Yeah, and there's been a real emphasis, I know, in Wisconsin, throughout the university system with tech schools, to make it easier for students to get in, to get what they need, the job skill, in order for the job placement to work or the education degree, and then get them out right away so that they're not lingering or having to stick around for an additional semester, which oftentimes leads to more loans having to be taken out in that financial hole that I was just talking about.
I've been looking at overall funding for the Pell Grants. Looks like it peaked in 2010. It's gone down, and there are fewer people using it since then, maybe because of those changes in eligibility. But if we compare it to about 10 years ago, we're still at a pretty consistent level. So where would you see new funding for this come from?
Well, you got to find an offset, and I've been a big believer in pay-as-you-go budgeting. If you're going to increase funding somewhere, finding an offset somewhere else, and there's plenty of areas in the federal budget that we can scrub and find savings in. I mean, my goodness, the Defense Department, for instance, is unauditable, given how bad the financial books are over there. We're still spending billions of dollars in outdated weapons systems that were maybe appropriate during the height of the Cold War against the Soviet Union, but they're not needed for the type of asymmetrical threat that we face from terrorism today. And the Pentagon, leaders themselves tell us this, and they tell Congress every year with a list of weapons programs they submit, get rid of it. We don't need it. It doesn't help with force readiness or what our troops need in the field. And yet every year, Congress finds money to appropriate for these weapons systems. We've got to be smarter in the limited resources that we have available. And I'm a big believer in investing in the next generation so that they can be successful in a competitive global economy.
Talking to Congressman Ron Kind about Pell Grants and other efforts to change to make college more affordable. And I want to get into some other things. The Pell Grant is just part of what you're hoping to accomplish, as I understand it. In a statement recently, you said government shouldn't profit from student loans. You're looking to see some money that is coming in from student loan interest, I guess, toward Pell Grants
right.
and other programs?
Yeah, right now, you know, interest rates on student loans were adjusted a couple of years ago. I oppose that because it exceeded the amount that we needed to raise to pay for the student loan program, which makes no sense because we could peg the interest rate on what it would take to cover the cost of administrating the student loan program. These students are the last group that we ought to be looking to raise money off from to use for other government programs or operations. And yet that's the way the current loan program works. We could be saving them thousands of dollars throughout the life of their loan if we were to adjust that down to just cover the cost so we can hold the program harmless. And again, it's just a very simple a fix that can be made that wouldn't cost us a whole lot, but would make a big difference in these student lives.
And then you also talk about refinancing, allowing students to refinance student loans.
Yeah, another simple, you know, based on home mortgages. You can consolidate the loans, refinance at a lower level. We allow it for homeowners to do. Why aren't we allowing this for students, too? And I'd go even further with the interest rate. I'd charge the students the same interest rate that the big banks on Wall Street are borrowing on, which is at rock-bottom rates right now. And I think if it's good enough for the big banks on Wall Street, it should be good enough for our student population out there.
And then taxes, our tax system is likely to change in the near future with the new administration and the Republican majority in Congress. You're hoping to use the tax system to create incentives to tackle college affordability.
I do, and I call for increased deductibility of student interest loan burdens so that you can write that off more. And in fact, an above-the-line deduction, so if you don't have a whole lot of taxable income but still are paying these student loans, that you'd qualify for tax credits in doing that. So some creative ways, too, that we're trying to alleviate the financial pressures that's building on our students today. I think it's paramount because the jobs of the future are going to put a premium on higher education skills, job training skills. We can't afford to be leaving anyone behind right now.
Anything else you could see out there that might help deal with college and technical college affordability issues?
Yeah, I'd like to see my home state in Wisconsin start stepping up and restoring the budget cuts that have happened throughout the years to the university system, to the technical school system, because it's really put us in a hole. Competition-wise, we're losing some of our best academic researchers to neighboring states because of the way they're being treated right now. And it's just sending this awful message to the educators that we need to educate our students that they're not welcome, that they're not valued. And states have a responsibility, too. This all doesn't rest on the federal government. We need a strong partnership to support the education programs, which will ultimately benefit the state's economy if we do it right.
Part of the problem with student debt is the rising cost of college. It takes a lot of money to go to school, university or technical college in many cases for that matter. Are there things that you see needed to cut costs to make it cheaper for students to go to school?
Yeah, Rob, that's a fair question. I've got 6 of the 11 state universities in my congressional district. I'm always asking that question with the administrators, the leaders of these universities. What more can we be doing efficiency-wise in order to make sure that these students are getting a good, valuable, quality education? So, you know, the ledger is always two sides. One is how you pay for it. The other is how can you reduce and streamline costs to make it more competitive, to make it more efficient for students. And I know our universities in Wisconsin have been working long and hard at that. Many of them have been instituting new energy programs that have drastically reduced the cost of energy on these campuses with the number of buildings that are in play. You know, we just need to be thinking out of the box of how we can deliver a more affordable yet quality education for our kids.
You've got these ideas, this legislation on Pell Grants and other college affordability issues. Your party is in the minority in both houses of Congress. Do you see room for bipartisan cooperation?
I sure hope so, because when it comes to the future success of all our children, this should be a nonpartisan issue. And there are certain key investments you've got to be willing to make as a nation in light of the competition that we're facing abroad today. And education, access to education programs is at the top of my list. And we've been blessed as a state of having the quality university system that's been developed throughout the years. But there's no guarantee that that reputation is going to continue in the future. And I'd submit, in a lot of ways, it's already been damaged. We're having a hard time recruiting the best and the brightest to come into Wisconsin to teach at our technical schools or at our universities because of the reputation now that Governor Walker has developed our state.
Congressman Kind, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Ron Kind. He represents Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He joined us to talk about new legislation he's proposing that would help fund the federal Pell Grant program to make college more affordable.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Sports have been called a great equalizer, a place where one's talent and drive can determine their success. But for some, barriers to participate and a feeling of unwelcomeness are still real problems.
In particular, people who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender can face difficulties in the world of sports, from hurtful slurs used by coaches to fear of coming out to their teammates. Our next guest is working to change that and help athletes advocate for members of the LGBT community within the sports world and beyond.
Hudson Taylor joins us now. He's a 3-time NCAA All-American wrestler and the founder of the group Athlete Ally, an organization working to foster an inclusive atmosphere in sports. He's speaking tonight in Madison at Camp Randall's Heritage Hall. Hudson, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you first become aware of this issue and get convinced that you wanted to do something about it?
Yeah, so I was a wrestler at the University of Maryland, but I was in a unique position because I was also a theater major. So I had the unique opportunity of being in two very different cultures, one where I had teammates who were using homophobic and sexist language pretty regularly, and the other where I was a part of a theater department that was welcoming and respectful for my LGBT peers. And I think that context really opened my eyes and made me realize, you know, there's a lot more that we should be doing to make sport a safe and welcoming space for everyone.
And talk about the kind of language you heard in that athletic setting. What kind of things did you hear, and is that common?
It's so common. You know, I now travel the country, visit probably 30 to 40 colleges a year, work with athletes at every age level, and I think two things are just kind of universal. Language like "that's so gay" is still heard, you know, by 95% of the student athletes I work with on a regular basis. And the second thing that's still all too common is that very few people are speaking out against it. And so I think while attitudes are certainly becoming more inclusive and welcoming, the language is not catching up with those attitudes. You know, so I think I see homophobia as a weapon of sexism, and so I think that a lot of the language stems from improper assumptions about masculinity and femininity, and sports culture, where, you know, we are judged against our peers. You know, it's a competitive reward structure. Athletes are taught to rank and measure themselves against their peers. And I think that homophobic and sexist language becomes a tool to put your peers down and lift yourself up. So, you know, I think we have a lot of work to do to try to change the way in which we teach about masculinity and femininity through sport, and then as well as educate our athletes on how they should be speaking to and about one another.
What do you think is the intent when this kind of language is used? Is it consciously homophobic, or is it just sort of a casual homophobia that people don't really think about?
I think it's very rarely done or said with ill intent. I think that a lot of our work and a lot of the challenge is sort of reconciling the difference between intent of language and impact of language. I think, you know, growing up as a wrestler, I never had anybody on my wrestling team who was openly gay. So as a result, when I heard that locker room language, I didn't think I should be speaking out against it, because I didn't think it impacted anybody in my life, anybody on my team. And so I think a lot of athletes, you know, fail to realize that difference between intent and impact. as well as sort of fail to realize how our words expand and resonate and impact people in unforeseen ways. You know, I may say something as a joke, and you may hear it as a joke, but we can never control how it impacts the people around us. So, you know, just bringing that level of awareness up in a conversation does a lot to change a locker room culture.
Well, I want to ask you how you got started in addressing this. You're on the team bus. You're in the locker room. You hear this kind of language. I mean, this is an awkward situation. How did you first raise these issues?
Yeah, well, I was at Maryland. I was in a really unique position because I was captain of my team. I was a three-time All-American athlete. So I was very much in a leadership position. And I think I really realized that I wanted to build a program and build a culture in which every one of my teammates could maximize their potential and feel comfortable and confident being themselves. So it started with just everyday conversations, asking questions of my teammates, you know, why is that the word you use? Why'd you say that? And sort of going from there. But the real catalyst for me in starting Athlete Ally and making this my life's work came my senior year at Maryland. I started the season wearing an LGBT equality sticker on my headgear to show support. And in response to that sticker, I got about 2,000 emails from closeted athletes from across the country. 2,000 emails from kids who wrote to me and said, you know, Hudson, I just read this article, and I'm going to try out for my wrestling team. I'm going to go into the locker room and not be afraid. And it was those stories and those emails that really, really struck me because, you know, my sport has been my entire life. It's made me my every friend. It's opened every door for me. And this idea that there continues to be, you know, an entire population of people that is systematically isolated or excluded or othered in sport is a tragedy. But, you know, I kind of realized if a wrestler could get that kind of response for doing something so simple as wearing a sticker, imagine if I had been a football player or a team or an athletic department. And so Athlete Ally sort of was born out of this idea that there's never been a successful social justice movement for a minority group without the support of the majority. That if we're going to really meaningfully tackle homophobia, transphobia, and sexism in sports, it can't just be the responsibility of those who are personally impacted by it, who shoulder the responsibility of ending it. So that's what I work now on a daily basis, is try to educate and activate more people in sports to start standing up and speaking out.
That was the positive response to wearing that sticker. Did you get pushback? Was there negative response?
Absolutely. I mean, I think on any social justice issue, there is always going to be a spectrum of opinion. I think that in LGBT work, there's still this assumption that you need to be a member of the LGBT community in order to care passionately about LGBT equality. And so, yeah, there were a lot of divisive, heated debates that I had with my teammates. But I think the thing that I always sort of learned through that process is, if we focus on what we're for instead of what we're against, we can always find common ground. I think that, you know, there are lots of reasons why people have various attitudes and beliefs towards the LGBT community. But I think, you know, regardless of whether it was my teammate or any of the athletes with whom we work today, I think people intuitively understand that sport should be a place where everybody can maximize their potential. And, you know, sport is in theory should be blind to your race, your religion, your sexual orientation. And so, you know, I think it's up to us to try to make sport everything we know it can and should be. So there definitely were some difficult conversations, and they definitely still come up every campus I visit. But I think, you know, diversity is beneficial to athletic success. The more we can create a culture in which athletes can feel comfortable being themselves, the better the team is going to do, the better legacy we're going to leave behind, both on the field and off.
We're talking to Hudson Taylor, three-time NCAA All-American wrestler and the founder of the group Athlete Ally. Hudson, athletes in particular, why do you see them playing an important role as allies to the LGBT and other communities?
I think sport as an institution is probably one of the greatest socialization mechanisms in the world. You look at the back of every newspaper, it's a sports section. You go to any high school or middle school in the country, and it's sports trophies that line the hallways. I think that athletes have a tremendous amount of cultural capital. And, you know, when I think about the most meaningful moments in sports, they are not necessarily, you know, a random championship, but they're the times when sport and social justice intersected. They are those stories of people breaking barriers, people who use their platform with a purpose. You know, Muhammad Ali recently passed away, and I think, you know, the world has saw him as an icon, not only for his athletic ability, but for the principles that he stood for. And so, you know, I think it's, if we can help educate and activate the athletic communities of this country and around the world to sort of use the principles of sport to champion equality, I think we're going to very quickly, you know, create a world that is far more equitable than the one we're currently living in.
And with Athlete Ally, you've been reaching out to professional and I think collegiate athletes. What kind of response have you gotten when you send this message to people who are in at the highest levels of the sports world?
It's been such a positive and exciting response. I mean, in the last year, we've seen more athletes come out, more allies speak out, more teams and leagues take a stand than at any other time in history. So it's a very exciting time to be doing this work. I think, you know, the challenge is that 9 times out of 10, when we're working with a professional sports team or an athletic department, it's the very first time that LGBT conversations have ever been had within an athletic context. So there is quite a bit of education that we still need to do, just to get everybody on the same page. But I think, you know, I have the opportunity to work very closely with the NBA. I've worked with all of the incoming NBA rookies for the past 3 years. So having the chance to work with athletes, you know, at such an elite level has really been a tremendous experience for me. And I think, you know, those athletes at that elite level also understand that, you know, in order to be a good teammate, they have to make a welcoming and inclusive space for everyone. I think also, you know, athletes have Twitter followers and fans and people who look up to them as role models and leaders. And so the more athletes understand that role and responsibility, I think the more they're empowered to use their influence to make the world a better place.
Looking at this through the lens of what we often see in the sports media, a response when there is a political message or a social message in the athletic world is, hey, whether I'm sympathetic to the message or not, sports is where I go to get away from politics and social arguments. So, you know, do that off to the side. Don't mix it into the sports. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the political is personal. As much as fans would love to sort of disconnect from the political realities of the world, you know, every athlete has a family and a story and is coming from a community that is impacted by some form of legislation. And so I think, you know, it's unfortunate that I think people want to give so much influence to these athletes, but then want to silence them or not hear from them on so many other aspects of their identity. You know, athletes, you know, being an athlete is only one part of their identity. They have a lot of things that they believe in and want to say and I think should have the right to say. And so, yeah, I mean, I understand that, hey, we love our sports and we want to, you know, cheer for our favorite athletes and favorite teams. But the reality is, you know, if we're living in a world and there's legislation or policies that are negatively impacting a given community, sport can be a very powerful tool in changing that type of discrimination. I mean, you look at the case in North Carolina, after the passage of HB2, you know, which was this anti-LGBT, quote-unquote, bathroom bill, you know, I think sport, the athletes and the teams and the leagues really came to stand with the LGBT community in recognizing that anti-LGBT legislation is counter to the values of sport. And so, you know, as soon as that reality is understood, there's a responsibility for the business of sport to respond to those cases of discrimination accordingly.
We'll leave it there for now. Hudson, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Hudson Taylor, founder of Athlete Ally. He's speaking tonight in Madison at Camp Randall's Heritage Hall.